This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen, alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. 5 times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wednesday, March 26th. Could be a little bit warmer than it has been today. I had a glimpse of summer yesterday, I think today as well. Highs of 81 today, 80 tomorrow. Chance for showers on Friday and Saturday. Don't let it keep you away from Wednesday at the square, though. It's going to be nice this afternoon. Saturday, 90% chance for showers, which is bad considering that's the makeup day for the Irish Channel St. Patrick's Day Parade. And then 83 for a high on Sunday, with more clouds. And looking ahead to next week, we're looking at the lower 80s. So spring is here, and it's starting to feel like it. We're going to talk with our friend Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst and Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies, about what's been going on with immigration and President Trump and executive orders. Good morning, Jamie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. Before we get to immigration, I just wanted to address this generally. I get emails daily from the Office of Communications from the White House with executive orders that the president has signed, and I can't even begin to count how many I have. And that just gets me to wondering about what's contained in these executive orders, because a lot of it, if you read them, is legalese. And a lot of them have consequences, and both intended and unintended. Is somebody keeping an eye on all of this or not? And I'm not saying that the president's doing anything wrong for the people that are big fans of President Trump. I'm just saying that there's a lot of stuff that's going on here, right?
There is. I do think it's important to note that President Trump isn't issuing really any more executive orders than a lot of other recent presidents, and certainly not any more than presidents during wartime. Okay. Executive orders typically come out when there is what we call exigencies, things like this isn't a normal time and we can't go through the legislative process, and we want the executive to be able to be nimble and quick and fast acting. And Donald Trump entered his second term really wanting to be nimble and quick and fast acting. The issue with executive orders is that there is a limit to what the executive branch is allowed to do. We have 3 branches of government, and the legislative branch, Congress, is supposed to do a lot of the lawmaking in this country. And so when an executive order does something that Congress is supposed to do, it's generally considered not valid. So, for example, creating or dismantling a government agency, that power is supposed to come from Congress. And so executive orders that do something like that usually don't stand up if they get challenged in court. Other executive orders are within the power of the executive branch, and the executive has powers to do that as long as they don't violate other provisions of the Constitution, such as unfairly discriminate against people based on their protected statuses like race, or other things that are pretty clearly not within the Constitution, like taking away somebody's rights to due process, that kind of stuff that is expressly in the Constitution and in our amendments that are designed to protect us from government power. The executive can issue an order, but if it gets challenged, it probably won't stand up in court.
So I guess if anything, what I'm hearing is that President Trump's being more forthright about it than other presidents, and I'm not trying to be judgmental, just observational, because we are getting the emails of it, and he is making a big deal out of the executive orders that he's signing, where he's not really doing anything that other presidents haven't done. He's just letting people perhaps know more about it. Would that be accurate, Jamie?
I don't think that's necessarily what's happening. One way to look at this is that most presidents, when they come into office, especially when they have both branches of Congress in the same party, try to make legal changes with legislation. Mm-hmm. And the reason they do that is that when you pass a law through Congress, it's not likely to change with the next presidential administration. Mm-hmm. If you pass a law in Congress, it's going to stick for a long time until you can get Congress to undo it, which is hard, right? Just like getting Congress to make a law is hard. What's different about what Donald Trump is doing is that he's not trying to make Congress make laws. That is different than what other presidents have done regarding executive orders. Typically, presidents have tried to create law with Congress as a partner, and if that doesn't work, then they issue an executive order. That's, for example, what Barack Obama did when it came to DACA for immigration benefits for youth that were brought here illegally. But Trump isn't even trying to start with legislation. He's immediately jumping to executive orders. That is different.
He's taking advantage, would it be accurate to say, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but he's just taking advantage of a vacuum that created because Congress sometimes, they don't want to get involved in this, maybe because they're worried about re-election?
Well, the problem is there's actually a very small majority for Donald Trump in Congress. He has a very few votes to lose, and many of these policies that he's trying to implement through executive orders are actually not as popular. And so it would be difficult for Congress to actually pass them. It might be hard for him to get all the votes he needs. He doesn't want to wait. He doesn't want to have it debated. He wants to make it happen right now. And so that's what's happening. Whether it's taking advantage or not, it's really more just not wanting to wait to create more durable legislation with Congress and to make it possibly lose.
Instead of saying take advantage, maybe I should have said seizing the opportunity. Let me phrase it this way, Jamie. I don't know if you're a football fan or not, but, you know, it's like the old thing of I'm going to run a ball till you stop me. And it seems as though, okay, this avenue exists, so I'm gonna use it until somebody challenges me. And until then.
I think that's exactly right.
Okay. Let me take a break. We'll talk about the Alien Enemies Act deportation and what's going on with that. Our guest, Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Society. 620 Traffic Now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. Jamie, let's talk about the Alien Enemies Act, the deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador with no due process, and what's going on there?
So what's happening right now is that we have an act that Congress passed in 1789. It's been used three times during war times, most notably during World War I and World War II, to hold people that were citizens of countries that we were at war with. And the act enables the federal government to detain and deport people without the due process they would typically be granted under the Constitution. It's only been used during war. And what Trump is saying is that the presence of members of a gang, alleged members of a gang, is akin to being at war, right, with a country. Mm-hmm. And that therefore people that the executive branch has deemed members of the gang should be able to be detained and deported without the typical due process that they would be guaranteed. The issue with this, and the reason it's getting a lot of attention, is that, first of all, there is no war. There is no declared war. And so there's a really big question about whether we can give the executive branch of government the authority to declare that this particular group is akin to a belligerent, right? Mm-hmm. The way we might think about Germans during World War I and World War II. And remember, this was used in a very famous case to detain Japanese citizens in the United States, people of Japanese heritage in World War II. And so it has a pretty storied history of being used basically for racial discrimination.
When you say detain, you're talking about internment of the Japanese, right?
Internment of the Japanese. And that was done under this law. And so this law has a complicated and its history in the U.S. So the first problem is, are we at war? No. Is this group of people akin to a belligerent nation? No. But the other big issue is that there has been absolutely no process to determine whether the individuals that were deported were part of the gang. Even in World War II, this is what a judge said yesterday, Nazis were given more due process to determine whether they were Nazis. And so in any decision by the executive branch to label a particular group of people, either, for example, terrorists during the war on terror or in this case, members of a gang or a belligerent group, there's a question about minimal due process to make that determination. And the executive branch, Trump administration, has decided they don't want to tell the courts whether they followed any process to make that determination.
Jamie, real quick, before we run out of time, I just got to get this in. And that is for people that say, well, I'm not Venezuelan or I'm not a member of the gang or I am a citizen, I'm not a non-citizen. Why should they be concerned about this?
That's a really good question. So the federal government, the Constitution was basically created with the promise that the federal government was not going to be able to pick people up off the streets and make them go away, that there was always going to be minimal due process. It is throughout our Constitution. And so doing this for one group of people is a slippery slope, and the concern is that that could be done for other people that the government disagrees with.
When somebody says that they're in the country illegally, are they necessarily in the country illegally, or are they non-citizens that are being deported here?
There are multiple categories of people who are here without status of citizen. And many people are here on legal visas, but they don't have the status of a citizen. And so a person who is here seeking asylum is not here illegally. They're here awaiting a status that would allow them to work or to participate in politics, but it doesn't mean they're here illegally, especially if they're from a country such as a Venezuelan or previously a Haitian. They have what's called temporary protected status, or they did. They were allowed to be here because going back to their country would be so dangerous. And so the United States throughout its history has welcomed immigrants from countries that were dangerous, and it gave people the legal right to be here.
So to wrap it up, the concern is erosion of due process?
Absolutely, is that we need to, for anyone, citizen, non-citizen, they should be able to be determined who they are. And so the claim that a person is a gang member without any process for that determination is a scary prospect under our Constitution, which again was written so that the federal government, so that no government would be able to take an individual and be able to make them disappear.
Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate your time and insight as always. Jamie Rawan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies, UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. We'll talk about a horrific dog attack when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we'll go to Dave Cohen. 6:46, 14 till 7 here on WWL, Wednesday morning, March 26th. Got a great concert in the square, in Lafayette Square this afternoon for you, absolutely free. Starts at 5. I'll give you details on that. Last Thursday, can you imagine your 81-year-old mother or any 81-year-old woman putting out the garbage and being viciously attacked when three pit bulls broke through a fenced yard and mauled her to death, sustained multiple dog bites to her body, transported to the hospital where she later died of the result, and the dog's owner witnessed at least one of the dogs biting the victim. All three animals were impounded. One of them, as I understand it, was put down. Alyssa Curtis, a talented young reporter at WWL-TV, did a story on this, and I saw last night she had Casey Singleton, the owner of Canis Integrated Behavior Solutions, on, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk to him. Good morning, Casey. How are you doing?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. I really do appreciate it. First off, there's a little bit of confusion. It is Casey or Casey?
Casey. Like Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Got it. That's what I figured. Let's talk about, you are an animal trainer, sir. Is that what you do? You train dogs?
Yes, I'm behaviorist and animal and dog trainer.
I don't know what that means, behaviorist. I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to figure it out what you do.
Basically, understand the psychology of canines.
Okay. So let's talk about, first of all, because, you know, it can be a lightning rod when you talk about pit bulls. I know, having had this job for decades now, whenever something like this happens, it seems like it's always pit bulls. If you look up the number of dog bites, people can argue statistically this, that, the other thing. Do you own pit bulls? What would you advise people that own pit bulls of?
Okay, basically, you want to get your dog trained. You want to understand the psychology of each breed that you own. It doesn't matter if it's a pit bull or a chihuahua. All dogs can bite. They all have tendencies. Some have more propensity to bite than others. Understand the breed. That's the most important part. Research your breed. Dogs go by a social hierarchy. Pit bulls are just stronger. They're probably statistically more in neighborhoods than a lot of other breeds just because of popularity. So that's why you're going to see more bites, because they're more popular. There's Labradors and other dogs bite as well, but you may not have as many in your neighborhood. There's a lot of pit bulls, so they're stronger, they're muscular, they have more jaw pressure. If not that, they're more aggressive than the other dogs. It's just that people need to understand that you have to take control of your dog. You understand the psychology. Contain your dog. Make sure your environment is safe and enclosed properly. Make sure you have structure in the household with your dog. Make sure your dog understands that he or she has to be under a certain hierarchy. We all have been raised in some type of hierarchy in our household. We have the dad, the mother, and then the children. They have their place in the pack, basically. Animals have a social hierarchy, as do most animals and humans. The problem is we as pet owners hardly ever explore the psychology and effects of social hierarchy. When domestic dogs are being bred over and over for dog shows or irresponsible backyard breeding, they lose the ability to communicate or exhibit the traits they were originally bred for. So therefore, they lose the ability to understand pack communication. They lose it if they are taken away from the litter too early. They don't get the proper socialization from the litter mates or the mother or the communication. And then we have the problem. So, and the owners don't always understand that. So I use dogs to help other dogs to communicate and understand social hierarchy. It's hard to find the domestic dog that has perfect communication. So we train them to have better communication skills, but we use good dogs that understand that. The main reason why we're having so many issues with our dogs because we as humans are not helping enough with our dogs' communication. I teach people how to communicate with their dogs. There's a certain language. There's human language and there's dog language. I teach people how to understand dog language, and I teach dogs how to understand human language. So we have to integrate the languages.
Casey, let me take a break, please. And I know we were supposed to talk to Anna Zarrillo. I'm going to push Anna because I want to keep this conversation going with you because I think it's very important. And I think what you said is very logical in that pit bulls are they're the Mike Tysons of dogs, right? So you gotta make sure that, and I shouldn't have brought a human being into this, but you got to understand what you're dealing with here. It's not the Pee Wee Herman of dogs. Pee Wee Herman can get in a fight with you as well. He's dead. I shouldn't have said that. But as well as Mike Tyson, but the results are going to be a lot more severe. Let me pick it up here. We come back. And also what you told Alyssa last night about things you can do should a strange dog approach you and ways to protect yourself. It's a very valuable conversation we're having with Casey Singleton, a behaviorist, owner of Canis Integrated Behavior Solutions. I love the way he said that he teaches humans to talk with dogs or communicate, and dogs to communicate with humans. A lot of times we think dogs are human beings, and they are not. 6:52, 8 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:57, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Casey Singleton, owner of Canis Integrated Behavior Solutions, about the dog attack that happened last Thursday. Three pit bulls got out and attacked an 81-year-old woman as she was putting her garbage out. Casey, you talked about people taking control of the animals. A lot of times, you know, I saw a guy walking a cane Corso at Petco some time ago, and you could tell he was not in control of this dog, and it frightened me for not only everybody in the store at the time, but for him as well when he got home. You don't have to be mean to the dog. You don't want to abuse the dog, but you do have to make sure that they understand that you're the alpha. Is that accurate?
Yes. If you understand alpha, David Meech was the guy that studied wolves, and he coined the term alpha. He redacted that because it didn't really apply to the wolves or domestic dogs. Mm-hmm. So basically, you have to be the dominant person or the person in charge as far as being more assertive, but assertiveness or dominance doesn't mean physical, okay? When your father walked in the house, you stopped because he had a certain energy. You have to be that person that delivers that energy and let that dog know you are in charge. This is what you're supposed to do. It's kind of difficult for some people because they don't understand that dogs aren't human, and they talk to them like they're human. Mm-hmm. They're not. You have to talk to them in a dog language, and there's techniques to do that. And a lot of it's non-physical.
Let me ask you before we run out of time, what do you do if you should be approached by a strange dog, or you sense that a dog is going to attack you? What's the best way to protect yourself?
Well, basically your arms, you have vital organs all over your stomach region, midsection, your neck, your face. You don't want to mess up your face, so cover your face up with your arms or your chest, your midsection. You really don't know where that dog is coming from or how he's going to attack you, but if you can put your arms up and block him, it's better to take an arm bite than a femoral artery or a neck bite and get the artery there. So, and turn away as quickly as possible, because if you're looking at a dog, it's a threat if he perceives it as a threat. Turn around. Don't run. Walk away slowly. Move slowly. If he bites you, just kind of block him. Let him bite if that's what you have to do. I mean, it's difficult. It's not an easy task. And if you're an older person or a kid, it's very difficult.
Thank you, KC. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you. Anna Zarilla, SPCA, when we come back. Thank you, Dave. 709, Anna Zarilla joins us, CEO of the Louisiana SPCA. We're talking about that horrific dog attack. You can find the story at odyssey.wwl.com. Happened last Thursday in New Orleans East. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Oh, good morning. Certainly I'm well, but with news like this, it is just gut-wrenching.
It is. And for people that want to be dog owners, and we just talked to KC Singleton about, you know, big, powerful dogs. What do they need to know in terms of what their responsibility is as a pet owner and to be both responsible for their pets, to their pets, and to their neighbors?
You know, in the city of New Orleans, we have so many wonderful pet owners who own all kinds of breeds, lots and lots of big dogs, and often, you know, we highlight all the positives, all the great things, all how much joy they bring us, the quality of life that gets enhanced with having companion pets. But the flip side of that coin is that level of responsibility that you as a pet owner have for the safety of your community. And so I see, you know, people walking their dogs off leash. That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. I've seen lots of folks with, you know, fences that aren't secure. And sometimes, you know, we have crazy weather and fences get damaged and we think, oh, you know, my dog's so wonderful, my dog would never hurt anyone. However, we forget there are lots of different triggers for animals, and all it takes is one small thing to trigger your dog. The sweetest dog, the best dog, the most lovely dog, and you're responsible for what that pet does. And so we have, you know, I think more and more dog bites happening throughout the city. We've seen some, you know, disfiguring dog attacks where people's bodies, you know, need plastic surgery, or they're going to have, you know, months, if not years, of pain and rehabilitation. And this case last week is hands down everyone's worst nightmare. And so it's important that, you know, we balance, you know, all of the good things with remembering that we have this really, really serious responsibility to maintain control over our pets, keep them in our property securely, and ensure that no one is hurt. And the most vulnerable in our communities are children and the elderly. And so we may say that a million times, you know, I am always messaging about that, but kids that are waiting at a bus stop and, you know, someone's dog gets out and they just aren't quite as, you know, worried about it. They'll get the dog in a minute. Those kids can get hurt. Your elderly neighbor who has met your dog 100 times and every time it's been okay, all it takes is that one time for your dog to get upset about something and now your neighbor's hurt. And in this case, you know, there's a fatality, and this is, it's so important. And we have to, as a community, step up, and we have to make sure that we keep each other safe.
I think sometimes people get caught up in this breed of dog or that breed of dog, when in really what they should be concerned with is the size of the dog, the strength of the dog, the weight of the dog. And what I mean by that is you got to understand whether you own a Nerf gun or whether you own an AK-47, right, or an AR-15, whatever it is. And I'm not trying to bring guns into this, but I'm just saying that, okay, a Nerf gun can hurt somebody, can maybe if you hit them in the eye or something like that. And I'm not trying to get too far into the weeds with this, Anna, but if it's a 5-pound dog, that's one thing, right? You still got to be a responsible
Absolutely.
Pet owner. But if it's a 50, 60-pound dog, then you really forget the breed. You need to look at what damage that dog can potentially do and view it that way rather than breed. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely. And what I tell people all the time is that it is not the appearance of the dog that tells you anything about its, you know, lineage. Almost every dog in the city has some Chihuahua and has some pit bull in it. I hate to say that, but it is true. Mm-hmm. And the bigger the dog is, the more damage that dog can do, even if it looks like a lab, even if it looks like a golden or a poodle. Every dog with teeth can bite. And the larger the dog, the stronger the dog, the more responsibility you have to make sure that you maintain that dog safely so that no one does get hurt.
And I'll admit it publicly for the first time. I'm pit bull on my mother's side, Chihuahua on my father's side. So there you go. Real quick, if somebody wants to rescue a pet, how do they do it? And
they can go online to LouisianaSCCA.org. You can see all of our amazing adoptables. We have all different sizes, big, medium, small, or you can come over to the Louisiana SPCA. We will be actually at PetSmart on Claiborne starting today, tomorrow, and Saturday with our adoptables and PetSmart on Manhattan. So you can actually just pop into the store and see the amazing adoptables there.
Outstanding. I'm glad that's happening. Glad we had you on. Thank you, Anna Zarrilla, CEO of Louisiana SPCA. We'll take a break, come back, talk about fluoridating water here on WWL. Sorry about that. 7:18, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at the LSU Health School of Dentistry. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. It's wonderful to be on the show.
Mosca or Mosca? I want to make sure I say it right.
So you can use either, but my family that owns the restaurant on the West Bank says Mosca.
Oh, that is your family. Been there. Great restaurant. Yeah. Let's talk about fluoridation of water. I learned a lot of things as a kid growing up by reading or seeing references to things in movies, and I can remember way back in the day talking about a communist conspiracy with fluoridation of water. I think the history of it in the country goes back to January of 1945. Doctor, if you can, give us a little timeline on and context of fluoridating of water and what it's the reason for it and what it's accomplished.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation, I should say, about this right now in social media and the news. So I appreciate this opportunity. So fluoride is a natural element. It's number 9 on the periodic table. It's right next to oxygen and iodine. And small amounts of fluoride help protect our teeth. It makes our teeth harder because in its natural state, it's a gas. But it loves to bind, so it'll bind with things like calcium, and it helps pull that mineral, calcium, into our teeth, imparting strength. It's also important because it has an antimicrobial property. We have a lot of germs in our mouth, bacteria primarily. Some people also have yeast and fungi, but that particular element helps kill bacteria in our mouths and impart hardness to our teeth. So it makes teeth resistant to tooth decay or cavities.
Are there any side effects? I mean, look, if I can eat anything in large enough doses and it's gonna hurt me, right? I can eat celery in large enough doses and it's going to hurt me, or the healthiest thing in the world, kale, whatever it is. Have there been any reputable studies that indicate any problems with fluoride in water at all?
All the studies that have looked at the amount of fluoride used in community water fluoridation, and so that's another important point that I should mention, the amount that is adjusted in the public water systems is under 1 milligram per liter. We call that 1 part per million. The actual amount is 0.7 milligrams. And so the tolerable intake in your diet, and not only does all bodies of water have fluoride, soil has fluoride, and as you mentioned, there's food in our diet that also contains amounts of fluoride. The tolerable intake for adults is 10 milligrams daily. So that's with no risk, and the studies have shown this. Where there has been studies that have shown some impact on our health is in places where there is abnormally high levels naturally in the environment. And the studies on this were done in China. They were done in India, Iran, and they were looking at water bodies that have this. They're not community water fluoridation programs. These are areas where there's abnormally high amounts. So we would have to drink 42 glasses of water a day to get to that 10 milligram daily intake.
That's a lot of water. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, and I'll just talk to you about, as a scientist, as a dentist, your disbelief, I would have to believe, in that we're taking this step back, and actually we're really talking about fluoridation of water. We're back to the 50s now. That's what we're doing. 722, talking to Dr. Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at the LSU Health School of Dentistry. Politics getting in the way of science. There have been some bills pre-filed to take fluoride out of water systems in Louisiana. 722, traffic now, WWL. I-725. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at LSU Health School of Dentistry. Yes, his family does own the restaurant, in case that's all you're going to be thinking of. Now we'll move on to fluoride in the water. Doctor, what would happen if fluoride is taken out of water, and what does it do to prevent dental decay in the general populace?
So if fluoride is removed from the water, then that's one less preventive strategy that we have for the population. And I would compare it to airbags versus seatbelts. So to prevent injuries in our when we're driving our cars, we do both. But sometimes we don't always put on the seatbelt, right? You have to think about that. That's an extra thing. So the airbag is kind of there to prevent an injury. And community water fluoridation works the same way. We have, since 1965, in addition to community water fluoridation, products that we can buy at the drugstore that contain fluoride that we use to brush our teeth. But we have young children who, again, to that issue of high amounts being a concern, we have young children who sometimes swallow toothpaste when they're brushing because it tastes so good. It has tropical fruit punch flavors, right? Mm-hmm. So we also have elderly. We even have people in the workforce, like truck drivers, who are on the road for 10 hours. So the community water fluoridation, if they're sipping that at the gas station, from the water fountain, or if they are drinking that in their vehicle, will prevent the decay when they can't brush. So it's additive, right? It helps. Removing it's going to increase costs for the consumer. It's also going to increase cost to the state through the state Medicaid program, because we pay out of pocket, or we have insurance, or we have support that helps us cover the cost of dental treatment. So removing community water fluoridation is going to sort of shift costs to us, because for every dollar we invest in a community water fluoridation system, we save between $20 to $32 in treatment costs.
Are you astounded that we're having this debate going back to the 50s or the 40s about fluoridation and water?
Yes. We're looking at, 80 years of doing something that suddenly is bad. And I think it's because people are misusing some of the research that I alluded to, where the research has nothing to do with community water fluoridation. The studies on that show no association between community water fluoridation and changes in IQ or any of the detrimental things that people are talking about. I think it's just that people are ill-informed because the science is sort of being used in a different way. It's being misread or misunderstood by people.
I'm going to say this in a tongue-in-cheek way, doctor, but if I'm a young man or woman coming out of dental school, I want them to take fluoridation out of the water because it's going to build my practice. Accurate?
Well, no.
Yeah, but also, go ahead. You know what I'm saying, though. Go ahead.
No, I do. Yeah. No, your point is that why would a dentist be saying this is important when it could also mean dollars out of my own pocket? Mm-hmm. And it's because we sometimes have to take people to the operating room and do general anesthesia, which is a higher risk procedure for both us and the patient, to provide the treatment. I mean, think about people that have developmental disabilities or elderly that have Alzheimer's disease. We don't want to subject them to that extra risk. And so we like the idea of being able to wear a seatbelt in our car and have an airbag to prevent an injury.
Because the ultimate goal is to take away any tooth pain or tooth problem, and that's why you're saying fluoridate the water. I get it. Thank you, doctor. I appreciate your time. I do, and hopefully we won't have to have you back, but I have a feeling we will. Have a good day. Thank you.
I mean, goodbye.
You bet. Dr. Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at the LSU Health School of Dentistry. And just believe when I heard, you know, Dr. Strangelove, 1964 in the movie, they're talking about fluoridation of water being a communist plot. Taking a break, coming back, talking with Matt Willard about financial literacy. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Nice day today, kind of warm, spring-like, and pretty much dry until, I think, 2 days from now. We'll have a chance for showers, but I think it's going to be the time of year where maybe there's an omnipresent chance for showers in the afternoon, barring some kind of front. The Louisiana regular session gavels in on April the 14th at 6 p.m. No, at noon, I think it is. Monday, April 14th, closes, set to close June 12th at 6 p.m. Some bills have already been pre-filed, one of which concerns financial literacy. It's been filed by Louisiana State Representative Matt Willard. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me about this bill and what you intend to do and hope to do with it and about the state of financial literacy in Louisiana.
So I have to give you a quick background. Around 2018, Louisiana was one of the first, if not the first state, to require high school students to apply for a FAFSA grant or TOPS, or complete a waiver that they did not want to apply for either one. Now, that's a great idea because we have a lot of students in Louisiana who come from poor households who do not know that college is an option for them. So if they apply for TOPS, if they apply for FAFSA and find out that they would receive money to attend college, then all of a sudden this becomes a reality for that student. Last year, BESSE, the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, decided to remove that requirement for whatever reason. And as a result, we are starting to see our numbers decline here in the state of Louisiana. Just to put it in perspective, while the nation is seeing a surge in the number of students applying for FAFSA, here in Louisiana, we've seen those numbers drop. Nationally, I think it went up by 14%. For us, it's down about 12%. Last year, in comparison to the other states, we were fifth with the percentage of students applying for FAFSA. We were fifth, and this year we're 29th. So obviously that policy change, eliminating that requirement to apply for FAFSA before they graduate, is already affecting our students in a negative way to me, because now a lot of students who would not think college was an option and had to apply for FAFSA are no longer required to do so.
So this bill would do what?
All right. So in 2023, the legislature added financial literacy as a required course to complete before graduation. Mm-hmm. My bill this session will add into that financial literacy curriculum that the schools have to teach the students about opportunities for scholarships, grants, and other ways to fund post-secondary education. So it's not re-adding the requirement to complete before graduation, but it is making sure that students in Louisiana high schools are aware of these opportunities so that they can be informed and make their applications if they want to pursue post-secondary education. So it's kind of a roundabout way to make sure at a bare minimum that the students know that these opportunities exist and that they could receive money to attend college once they graduate from high school.
I know you're a Jesuit graduate as well as UNO. I'm a UNO graduate. I went to Shaw. My kid went to Catholic high school.
I won't hold that against you, Tommy.
That's all right. And I won't hold the Jesuit thing against you, Matthew. That's the way we are in the Catholic League.
Thank you, Tommy.
No, but the reason I say that is they have in Catholic schools a pretty aggressive program, at least as I remember, to tell you how to get aid, how to apply for this, how to apply for that. But that's not in the public schools. That's what you're saying?
Well, I don't necessarily want to phrase it like that.
You want to make sure it's there.
I can tell you
Okay.
My experience at Jesuit was phenomenal, right? I had an academic advisor. They helped me with college applications. They made sure I was aware of deadlines and the essays. They would help with all of that. But you're paying for a lot of that extra support, right? I mean, that's why parents choose to pay for their kids to attend some of those private and Catholic schools. For Louisiana, we had a great law on the books, right? We were, I think, the first state to require this. And unfortunately, we're also the first state to eliminate it. So nationally, you see a trend in the right direction. Students across the country applying for FAFSA grants, while Louisiana is going in the opposite direction. And we do, I think, have some things moving forward in the right direction in the state of Louisiana. This should not be something where we're going in the opposite direction.
And I think also, just to be accurate about it, I'm not saying as a negative thing, I think private schools, Catholic schools, like to be able to brag about how many scholarships their kids got because it's a selling point to attract new students, how many grants they got, how many this, how many that. So I think that's an incentive on their part as well. We'll pick it up with Representative Matthew Willard when we come back. We'll also talk about some other things that hopefully they'll look at in the regular session, specifically insurance, both home and auto, and if anything can honestly be done about any of that. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:58, Tommy Tucker. Quickly back to Representative Matt Willard, Louisiana State Representative, talking about financial literacy and applying for financial aid. Matt, earlier I mentioned that, Catholic schools, a lot of times they like to get scholarships, not only to help the students, but it's a bragging point. Like, your kid comes here, we got this many scholarships. Along those lines, when it comes to UNO, and I know your story, you grew up painting houses and then educated yourself and succeeded, and I think your story and mine is kind of similar, and UNO had a large part to do with a lot of the success that we've had. Real quick, what can be done to put butts in the seats at UNO and make it a successful university, because it has to stay around?
So the Board of Regents is conducting a study on the long-term viability of UNO. They're weighing a decision between moving from the UL system to the LSU system. And part of the research has to be what will be the move to increase student enrollment. That is the one thing that will save UNO. Short term, we need to get some money to UNO so that we can right-size the ship. Long term, we have to increase student enrollment. And so I'm anticipating and patiently waiting on that study from the Board of Regents, which should give us some sort of indication on whether the UL system or the LSU system is better for attracting students, not only from the greater New Orleans area in Louisiana, but possibly even outside of Louisiana.
Thank you. Kind of muggy outside, 66 degrees, going up to 80 today, about the same tomorrow, chance for showers Friday. And unfortunately for Saturday, they have the reinstated Irish Channel St. Patrick's Day Parade, 90% chance for rain. We'll have to see what happens there. Ronald Serpas joins us now, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, now a professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. Talk about crime as we always do. Morning, Chief. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. How are you today?
I'm all right. You know, I always love to pick your brain, and before we get to crime stats and so forth. This the tragic death of Sergeant Candies in St. Tammany Parish. I would remind people there's a GoFundMe account that's been set up for his family, left behind a wife and two kids. They've raised $57,504 so far, and if you can help, go to the GoFundMe page and help if you can. But I know you can't talk to this case specifically because you don't know all of the particulars involved, and I don't know that anybody ever will. But, man, if you go back and just from what you've studied in your life's work and criminology and so forth and your experience, how in the world do you wind up with a car full of 17-year-olds, a 37-year-old man, by all accounts, just a good guy in public service, loses his life trying to stop people driving like crazy. A 17-year-old makes the decision to run him over. Now you got three 17-year-olds charged with first-degree murder. You have a 37-year-old man dead that was a contributing member of society, a father, a husband, and a very good deputy by all accounts. And I'm just wondering, Chief, I know inevitably people are going to break bad and there's going to be trouble and criminals in society, but how would you ever go back and stop something like this from happening, generally speaking, if you understand what I'm asking you?
Well, I do, and like you, I want to first and foremost express my sympathies and condolences and prayers for Sergeant Candice, his family, the men and women of the Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Randy Smith. When you're the boss, you know, these are the kinds of things where you have so many opportunities to help so many people, the law enforcement community. But there's two ways of thinking about this. First, wait to listen to all the reasons why these three young men are really not bad guys. They're victims of a society that treated them poorly. That's when it starts to really frustrate people. Mm-hmm. Secondly, policing is a goddamn dangerous job. And when we have this last 4 or 5 years where there was a political imperative to demonize the police, they did so in a way where they forget that young men like Sergeant Candies are going to be killed doing the work to make other people safe. The third thing is, Tommy, I'm almost 65 now, and I'm sure this is an acronym that a lot of my friends and colleagues are going to say, oh, I can't believe you said that. You got to have a mama. You got to have a daddy. You got to have rules. You got to have consequences for breaking rules. We hear a lot about adolescent brain development and the child's frontal lobe hasn't developed consequences yet. Well, not being a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I'm fairly certain that if you're not instilling consequences through the behavior of a strong family network, you're also likely going to exaggerate that lack of consequence development. I think, final point, 45 years in this business, 34 years as a police officer, the commonality of young kids making these choices also has almost a direct relationship in every single one of them to a broken nuclear family, to a broken family experience, to a lack of public education participation, to a lack of an ability to be held accountable by the people closest to them, who therefore feel they're not accountable to anyone. And to wrap up what I started with, wait till you hear the chorus concert of people saying it really wasn't their fault. No, it was, and Sergeant Candies is dead because of it.
It was their fault, but you just listed a bunch of contributing factors, right?
Absolutely, and you know, we've been beating our heads against this for a very long time as a society, and I don't pretend to know everything. I just know what I saw 34 years in policing, and as we continue to travel the country, graced with the opportunity to consult with so many police departments of all sizes, from the very largest to the very smallest, and you see the same behavior with juveniles around the nation, that they just don't have anybody caring for them, they don't have anybody making sure they're cared for, are the ones who will generally end up in this kind of condition. Not all of them, and you know, I do always try to remember the balancing act here too. Tommy, these are three kids in New Orleans. Let's assume there's probably 25, 30,000 kids that age near their neighborhoods, but these are the three who got in trouble. They're usually the ones with the most obvious deficits in family, in connectivity to society, and connection to social norms, and connection to school, and connection to commitment to social behaviors. Those are some pretty deep sociological ideas, but they actually work to understand this. And it always is going to be heartbreaking to hear people now come forward and say, well, we knew these kids were on the wrong path for 17 years, but somebody just couldn't intercede on their behalf, and now we have to bury a man who has children who woke up that night and said, I'm going to go to work and make this place safer.
Let me take a break.
And
we're
his
pick...
life was taken from me.
Yeah, let me take a break. We'll pick it up.
It's a very important thing. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, Chief, what?
What happens is Sergeant Candy's life was taken from him. He gave in public service, but it was taken from him in the middle of the night by people who have no respect or care for anyone else on this planet. His life was taken.
Let me pick it up there when we come back, and that's what I wanted to ask you about because, I think about a 17-year-old charged with first-degree murder, and look, I'm not taking up for the guy in the car or anything else, but I just can't imagine being 17 years old. First of all, when a police officer pulled me over when I was 17 years old, I was terrified and would do whatever had to be done, not to mention, think about even driving off and then intentionally running over a police officer. That doesn't just happen. You don't go from being on the honor roll to Breaking Bad. And I just want to look at historically going back to at what point is it too late? At what point do kids go off on the wrong track? And at what point is it too late to bring them back? And I know you can't speak to this exact situation, but as you're saying, this is one in God knows how many hundreds of thousands. 822 traffic now, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Ronald Serpas, our friend, professor, practice Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief, head of several departments, consultant, nationally known expert when it comes to these kind of things, about the murder of Sergeant Grant Candies. It was not an accident. It was a murder, and the people that are responsible for it are charged with first-degree murder. Chief, 17 years old, I mentioned before the break, I can't even imagine running from the police, let alone intentionally running a police officer over. What do the statistics show, generally speaking? Because I don't think you go from being an honorable student at 17 to turning into a criminal, right? I mean, are there studies that indicate there's an age where it's you still got time to intervene to keep the kid on the right track and ages where it's too late?
Actually, I'd answer that question in the other way. There is a lot of research to suggest that many young children are going to have some delinquent acts. Sometimes people say up to 80% of them are going to get out of it after the first time. Mm-hmm. So really, we do know that young people are going to experience testing the system. But it's having people there to keep you in the system that helps you be that 80 to 90% that drop out. Then you're going to have a percentage of kids who probably didn't have any of those support networks at all, and they end up continuing into criminality, and it is a very small percentage. So I always want to recognize the tens of thousands of young people who, whatever their reasons, their family, their support networks, whatever, they touch delinquency and they back out. The ones who stay in delinquency tend, in my experience, to be the ones who have no support, who generally are a single family headed household, who no male figure shows up in their life to help them just as much as you need a female figure in your life. And I'm going to get hate for this, but I don't care. I had to have a mother and a father to change my delinquent behavior when I dropped out of high school and did all those things. It was the two of them, and that's a personal experience, but I know from research and work, you need that kind of experience. Now, somebody needs to bring you to a T-ball field and say, hey, you can do this, or no, you don't do that. And Tommy, I want to really drive this point home. The memorial will say often that Sergeant Candy gave his life in service, and he did. Mm-hmm. But he gave his life in service every day. Three nights ago, somebody booked his life. And it's such an important distinction that's often lost. The memorial is right. He gave his life in service. No greater calling has a man on earth or a woman on earth, according to God. But that's not the same as somebody taking it from him. And they took it. And this weekend, people of Louisiana are going to be voting on whether or not to return 17-year-olds to the age of adulthood. These are three 17-year-olds who arguably, and you're going to say, acted with clear intention as adults. Would they be treated as adults? And there's a lot of debate in the country about what age is adulthood. But these are the kind of things that voters probably go, this is something that we shouldn't have.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate your insight and your thoughts on that. You can go to GoFundMe.com, support family of Sergeant Candies killed in the line of duty. It's up to $57,579. And Lord knows, if you want to do something proactive, you can help his family, his wife and two kids left behind. And I know what kept me out of trouble, and I guess if you want to call it a brush with delinquency, and I remember one time, one or two run-ins with the police, I was terrified of my parents finding out, and I guess that goes to what the chief was talking about with mom and dad at home and parental authority and responsibility and so forth. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Freddie King, council member for District C, about town hall meeting, Bourbon Street security changes, and more. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45 now, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by fellow Shaw graduate Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member. How you doing, Freddie?
I'm good, Tommy. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Where'd you go to college? I'm trying to remember, though.
Southeastern.
Let's talk about...
I met my wife.
Really? And for those that don't know, I met Freddie's wife getting gas a couple of weeks ago and found out they got how many kids? 15?
Five.
It seems like 15 sometimes, I'll bet you. What are the ages?
It does. The oldest is nine.
Nine, so, and the youngest? The youngest, Freddie?
Two. Nine, seven, five, three, and two.
Y'all say a couple of Hail Marys for Freddie and his wife because they're going to need it. Let's talk about the meeting tonight. First off, set the stage for me. Tell me where it's going to be, who it's open to, and what you hope to accomplish.
The meeting is open to the public. It's going to be at the Omni Royal at 621 St. Louis in the French Quarter, a couple blocks away from the from the 8th District Police Station. It's a meeting hosted by NOPD, DC Pora. I will be in attendance along with, of course, other residents, elected officials, to hear the plans moving forward as it relates to pedestrians in the French Quarter and just overall protection on Bourbon Street and surrounding streets in the French Quarter as it relates to vehicular traffic.
Have you noticed a change in either perception or attitude, or I don't know what word to use really here, or thoughts of people since January 1st? Here we are on March 26th.
As we said, change in
meaning after people, January 1st, everybody was maybe freaking out, where now after some time has passed, they're thinking, well, maybe we don't need to be as strict as perhaps we thought we needed to be.
There has seemed to be a sense of maybe calmness, I would say.
Yeah, because trying to say, Freddie, it's only natural. When something like that happens, the first thing you do after your house gets broken into, is, and I'm not trying to minimize this at all, is you want to go in a full lockdown, right? But then after some time passes, then you kind of get to thinking, well, what's real and what's not, what's practical, what's not, that kind of thing is what I'm saying.
So I have seen that, and I have talked to a lot of people, businesses, residents, even visitors. And I think they're realizing, or they're now questioning, what are we going to give up for a heightened sense of security?
That's what I'm saying.
Talked to officers, Captain Sam Palumbo, the new 8th District captain. He said, we can do certain things, but what are you willing to give up? And when you give up certain rights and certain liberties, you're no longer what you used to be and what you want to be. And we had a great conversation, he and I and other officers in the 8th District, about what's practical, what's not practical. One thing that he mentioned, that other officers mentioned, is if we completely shut down Bourbon Street, who is going to man that? It's going to take officers. And we already know that NOPD 8th District is doing more with less. So you want us now to take officers off the street? The 8th District goes from Calliope all the way to Esplanade. So we're going to take officers out of Marigny, out of the CBD, out of other parts of the French Quarter, and just focus on one street. Then those other areas now come less secure, less protected. So it's not, you've mentioned it before, this is not a easy solution. It's a complex situation. And it won't just take a magic, it won't be a magic wand or snap of a finger to make everything right. It's going to really be some thought behind it. Of what are we going to give up? What do we want to focus on? Another thing that was mentioned is we look at what the terror did successfully. let's look at what he did not do successfully, the bombs that he placed along the street. Like, how are we going to now protect ourselves from those situations? So, again, it's not just a simple one-trick pony, one-size-fits-all. It's going to be more conversations, hearing from the people who live on Bourbon and inner French Quarter, because if you lock down all of Bourbon, that's some of that is residential. Now you're preventing residents from getting to and from their homes. So there are some thoughts of what can be done, a certain time frame of when we're going to open Bourbon to who, delivery trucks, business trucks. But even with that, Tommy, where are you going to start the check-in? Are you going to start it on Bourbon and Canal? Can you imagine the traffic nightmare? You have 30 pickup trucks lined up on Canal Street waiting to be checked in. Are you going to do it on Iberville? That's where the French Quarter starts. If you do it there, that may be you may open up traffic a little bit, but now you're going to give somebody the opportunity, possibly, to get a blockhead start if they wanted to do something nefarious on Bourbon Street. So there's always pros and cons. There's always takes and gives. It just has, we have to figure out what's the best solution, what's the most practical solution, and come up with a solution that satisfies our residents, our businesses, and our visitors.
I think that's presuming, let me take a break, Freddie, there is a, quote, solution, because I don't know how you really could ever make it perfectly safe. I'll talk about Teneo with you when we come back, what they're expected to present, but I don't know. It's the cost of living in a free society in America, and then everything you just mentioned has nothing to do with guns, and that's always a threat if somebody wants to go crazy and do something stupid. 852, 8 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back with Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member, represents the French District Town Hall meeting tonight at the Omni Royal Orleans Hotel, 621 St. Louis, from 5:30 to 6:30. Freddie, I've been known to place a sports wager or two, and I'll tell you this, ain't no way that meeting's going to be just an hour, but we'll see. tell me about the company that was contracted, Teneo. What are they expected to present? Do you know, or have you seen it yet?
So, no, Teneo will not be present tonight. That information was a bit premature.
Okay.
It was put out there prematurely. They would not be presenting tonight.
So I mentioned earlier about everything you mentioned, and I'm getting texts about don't close it off too much. Other texts saying it's easy to do like they do at Jazz Fest or at the Superdome, but that doesn't take into consideration that when it comes to the French Quarter, state law and guns, which we didn't even address everything that could cause. I mean, I don't know. As council member, I don't envy you, because I don't know. It all comes down to what you said. It's what you're willing to give up for what you're willing to get. And because of the nature of Bourbon Street, I don't know how you ever make it completely safe, do you? I mean, this was a one-off. You hate to say it that way, but I'm not trying to diminish any of the severity of the attack. They noticed a weakness, but there are weaknesses all over the city, all over the French Quarter. And to isolate Bourbon Street seems, I don't know, kind of nonsensical
and
to me.
Also, Tommy, I want to remind people, Bourbon Street is a residential area. French Quarter is a neighborhood. People live there. So it's hard to expect someone just to block off a street, and now I'm a resident. How do I get to and from work and school and the grocery store if we block off parts of Bourbon Street? It's not a simple answer, and it's going to cost money. A lot of money was given from the federal government because we were a Tier 1 rated event because of Super Bowl and Mardi Gras. A lot of those funds are not gone. So, again, who's going to man Bourbon Street? Who's going to be at those cross intersections to make sure folks don't cross? There's going to be places where people can cross. It's unfair to NOPD to say, hey, take five people from the Meriden, take five folks from the CBD.
Got you, Freddie. All righty, let's talk now about some architecture, Dahlin in New Orleans. This lady was on to talk about why buildings were collapsing, and it made me think about the story of architecture in New Orleans, and I think it's an amazing one. Danielle Del Sol joins us, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. Good morning, Danielle. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
I am great. Thank you. Tell me, for the audience, to refresh your memory, what we were talking about last time you were on.
Yeah, so we were talking about historic buildings and the need to keep them well maintained because they're old and, you know, they were built with fantastic materials. That's why they've lasted 100, 150, maybe even 200 years. But we can't take that for granted. We always have to check up on our wood and our brick because when buildings are neglected, they fall down.
And that's not good.
No, it's not. It's dangerous. And unfortunately, we have a lot of blight in the city. We do have people who don't take care of their buildings. Maybe they don't even live in New Orleans. A building has been empty. And that affects a whole block. It affects a whole neighborhood when people don't take care of their property.
I think it's amazing how we take for granted the architecture of the city and so many things that are around us. And sometimes, in a way, because there is blight, we wish that we lived in a city that was more, I hate to say cosmopolitan, but you know, like, yeah, you can go to, what's the city in Florida where people go seaside? Yeah, it's nice, but there's no real character to it or anything. It's nice and neat, but do you really want to live there? Let's talk about some of the specific architecture, and I wanted to start with shotgun houses because the history of it, I would love, Danielle, to have a piece of ground and build a big piece of ground with a beautiful brand new shotgun house on it. How did that all get started here in New Orleans?
Shotgun houses are extremely practical. So they really started as a working class form of architecture, and you know, they were affordable, and they were also an affordable way to live with multi-generations. So if you have a double shotgun, you have two units, you know, other places in the country, that's called a duplex. We call it a double. You could have, you know, the grandma or the aunts and uncles on one side and you live on the other side, or you could rent it out and pay your mortgage with the rental income from the other side. So, but they were an economical housing form. So no hallways, typically. You just go from room to room, and they were called shotguns because the doorways lined up, and you could literally fire off a shotgun, and the pellets would go from one end of the house all the way through out the back.
Is that a uniquely New Orleans thing, a shotgun house? Because that's, somebody texted that in. By the way, I want to welcome the audience in at 504-260-1870 if you have any questions about the history of New Orleans architecture, maybe architecture, that's how I'll say it. If you have any questions about maybe what's a myth, what's true, what's not, Danielle will clear it up for us, 504-260-1870. And the first question somebody texted in is, were shotgun houses a New Orleans product, or was that imported from somewhere else? What's the history of the, quote, shotgun house, as you just said, because you could fire a shotgun from front door through the back door, right?
Right. The history is a bit contested. A lot of people believe that it is a an African building form that came by way of Haiti and the other Caribbean islands. So either enslaved people brought this building type, or free people of color coming from Haiti could have also contributed. But we have more shotgun houses than anywhere probably in the world. Certainly in the United States, you'll find a smattering of shotgun houses in Texas or in other places, maybe even in neighborhood. You know, you might go to Nashville or Atlanta and see some historic neighborhoods. Maybe you'll find a shotgun house. Maybe, I'm sure there's some in Mobile, plenty in Mobile.
Maybe Charleston, possibly.
Yeah, maybe Charleston, but no one has shotguns like we have. And I'll tell you, the Uptown National Register Historic District is the largest National Register District in the country. For those of you who don't know, the National Register of Historic Places is the kind of the directory of all the most historic places in the country. Uptown is a National Register District. We have 24 here in New Orleans. And fully one-third of the buildings in Uptown are shotgun houses. So over 18,000 historic structures in Uptown, over a third are historic shotguns. You're not going to find that anywhere else in the country. And you're right, we take it for granted, but we shouldn't, because it's really a special thing.
Is there something intrinsic to New Orleans that made shotgun houses attractive? And let me take a step back and talk about what is the traditional shotgun house, if I'm looking at it from above or walking through it?
Mm-hmm. It's a narrow rectangle, essentially, where you can, you know, there's, you go from room to room. You may start in a living room, go through a dining room, then you have a bedroom, you're just walking straight back, and then in the back you're going to have a kitchen. That's kind of the old school way. Now, people have customized them through the years, and the thing that's been really special about shotguns and the reason they've proliferated is because they're so customizable. You can have a single shotgun. You can have a double shotgun. You can have a camelback. You can have a side hall. You can have any sort of variation. And then the shotgun is the building form. You can decorate it any way you want. On the front, you can have a Greek Revival look with, you know, boxy columns. Or you can have Italian 8 with fanciful brackets. You know, people got really creative. You can have arts and crafts style, where it almost looks like it belongs in California. But one thing I'll tell you is we have, you know, these buildings were built to correspond with the climate. We have transoms above these doorways that line up. And if you want privacy, you keep your doors closed, you open those transoms, and because all those doorways line up, you have a cool breeze that comes through that house. Remember, these were built before air conditioning, so you had to have that cool breeze to survive in the summer. But you also have a front porch for commiserating with your neighbors, saying hello. And that is something that new places like Seaside have completely copied. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the buildings might be new, but they've taken all the best elements of New Orleans architecture and other historic architecture from across the country and brought it back. And that's why people love it.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be negative, but they're faking the funk, Danielle, and you know they are. They're faking the funk. Somebody texts in, allows any breeze to travel straight through. I can remember going to visit family members where they would have the front of the house of the shotgun house was a bedroom, and you would walk in, and that would be somebody's bedroom. Was that common, or do you know how they were pretty well laid out, how the shotgun houses were laid out?
Typically, the front room was more of a living room, mm-hmm. Because it does correspond with the street. And then the bedroom would be more in the middle of the house. But, you know, people would just, because you're piling so many people into these houses sometimes, you just kind of switch them around as you need to. And then in modern times, of course, we have people adding on hallways or, you know, subdividing rooms to create hallways so that you don't have to walk through bedrooms, because that's really not a way we like to live in modern day.
Yeah, I remember a kid walking in a shotgun house or a hunter's house in Gretna, and it was Uncle Claude in his athletic shirt, whatever you call those shirts, you know, without the sleeves, in his bed. And even at 7, I thought that was kind of odd, but, well, you know, whatever. Somebody texted in and wants to know, why do we paint the ceilings of our porches light blue? Is that
a
thing?
Yeah, so that is very much a thing. And there's different variations depending on what paint company you use on what the exact blue is. Mm-hmm. But people call it Haint blue. It's a beautiful light sky blue. And there's two explanations, and either both are right or one is right. I don't know. You can pick or choose which one you like best. But the first, it comes from African traditions. And we see this in the Gullah Geechee people from South Carolina, the enslaved people who were brought there and then settled there, that haints or spirits, bad spirits, they didn't want them to congregate around the house. And so they put the sky blue color so that the haints would just keep flying, fly away, thinking that was the sky. So that is one theory, and that's why it's called haint blue. The other theory is more practical, which is that insects or wasps, you know, things that build nests, will think that that is the sky because it's the same color, and they will not build a nest there. Now, I'm not going to tell you whether or not a wasp can see color or not. So I don't know the validity of that theory. But those are the two thoughts behind why we choose that beautiful sky blue and why it's so ubiquitous across the city.
Somebody texts in, called it mud dauber blue. I will tell you this. I don't know about if wasps can see color or not, but Danielle, before you ever use any of this wasp spray, make sure you test fire it. Because there's nothing worse than going in half-cocked where you let go a little bit with the trigger and there's not enough backup and all you do is anger them. You don't want that to happen at all. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up.
No, that sounds very scary.
When we come back, we're having a fun hour talking to Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. If there are any houses in New Orleans that you wondered about, there's one on Carrollton Avenue that always got my attention that would appear to be Asian in influence, and it just seemed to stand out to me. I don't know why that was there. Somebody else texted and said, thought that the property tax was charged by the width of the property. That's why they built shotgun houses narrow with long length. I'm sure there's a story for each and every shotgun house and everything you see in the city. We'll talk about camelbacks and more when we return. If you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Talking about the architecture of New Orleans when we come back on WWL. It is 9:25. We talk about so many serious, heavy topics here. We thought we'd take an hour on a beautiful spring morning and just appreciate everything that's around us with the architecture of the city. We're talking to Danielle Del Sol, our friend, executive director of the Preservation Resource Center New Orleans. Danielle, before we move on to camelbacks and more, tell me about the Preservation Resource Center.
So we are a 50-year-old nonprofit dedicating to preserving and revitalizing New Orleans historic architecture and neighborhoods and cultural identity. So, you know, back to what you were saying before, Tommy, we kind of take this historic landscape that we have for granted, but we shouldn't. It is completely unique in the country. I'll tell you, we had a conference of over 1,000 architects that came and people who came from across the country in October, and they were just floored. People kept coming up to me saying, I cannot believe how much beautiful architecture New Orleans has. These incredible neighborhoods are walkable. This is a really special, you know, asset that we have, a cultural asset. It's our history, it's our wealth, and it deserves protecting and revitalizing. I mean, shotguns aren't just old and inconvenient. You can bring them back and make them new and fabulous. That's why 18 million people visit the city every year, is to experience our, you know, experience of food, get their drink on, listen to music, but it's all done in this incredible historic setting. So we're dedicated to preserving it. We have lots of fun house tours, classes, and we help low-income, moderate-income people with home repairs through our grant programs. So I encourage everybody to check us out.
I know this is America. You can do what you want with your property. But one thing that just angers me, and I should say, first of all, it encourages me, just people need to get around and drive around what's going on in old Algiers and on Chapatula Street and everywhere else to see the renovation of houses that are going on. But when I see these Airbnbs, and they scream Airbnb. You know what they are. They're cosmopolitan. They have no personality, no nothing. It's strictly put them up as fast as you can with as many, the least features that you can, just to make it someplace for people to stay. How much of a problem is that, Danielle?
It's been a huge problem. It has led to dramatic property rises in some of our more historic neighborhoods, like the Treme, and that has pushed people out of their homes. But it's a catch-22, Tommy, you know, because we all like enjoying higher property values, you know. If we go to sell our house, we want to get as much as we can. And so it's a challenge to balance, you know, the Airbnb situation. I will agree with you, though, when they are developed strictly to be mini hotels, so many of our historic houses are just stripped of their original elements that make them so special. Those things are tossed in a dumpster. You know, gray paint goes up on the walls and all the character is lost. And so it's a real shame and it's a problem. And I'm glad that the city council is, you know, continuing to look at Airbnbs as a problem in our city, but figure out a way to manage it, because it does, you know, it can work well for people when it's done right and when, you know, homes are lovingly cared for. It's done, you know, for a little extra income or something like that. But when people from out of state come in and just buy up a bunch of houses and turn basically a block into a hotel, that's not fair to the people who have lived there for generations.
I can't define it. It's kind of like the old thing with the Supreme Court and pornography, Danielle. I can't describe it to you, but I can drive down the street and I can point one out to you. You know what I'm saying, right?
You know when you see it.
You know it when you see it, absolutely. Let's talk about a camelback. Somebody texted in and you mentioned camelback. What's a camelback?
A camelback is basically just a second floor that goes on top of a shotgun, and it doesn't extend typically all the way to the front, but it does get close to the front line of the first floor. And it's a second floor to provide more living space, because a lot of times shotguns can be smaller houses, and so camelbacking a house, some camelbacks are original. So I live in a 1905 single shotgun with an original camelback, and it was actually developed when it was first built in 1905 as a separate apartment. So when we renovated our house, we turned it into bedrooms for our family. Mm-hmm. But camelbacks can be original. A lot of them are new. It's a way for people to keep a historic house intact, but get a little bit more space so that, you know, they don't have to move or leave their neighborhood as their family's growing or as they need more space in their home.
Somebody texted in taking me to task for saying Danielle instead of Danielle. Am I doing the wrong thing there or not, Danielle? Danielle?
No, Danielle is correct. You got it.
All right, because I don't know. People complain about everything. Lord only knows that's all they can complain about. When it comes to somebody texts in about buying a home and buying a home that's old and renovating it, how do you know what to keep? How do you know what to get rid of? How would you go about even beginning that, beginning to know what's valuable when it comes to Cypress or what's trash and what's treasure?
We, you know, PRC has tons of resources for that. And so I encourage people to just call us. Just call the PRC. We will walk you through it. We offer classes, too. If you want to get more in-depth, you can, you know, take a class. Or you can hire a professional. There are preservation professionals across the city who do this work. And we have a list of them at the PRC. So we're happy to refer you. But a lot of this stuff can be saved, can be brought back to new. And that's one thing I want to stress with the listeners is just because something is old, maybe it looks ratty, that doesn't mean you should throw it away. It can absolutely be revived in so many cases. And especially if it's something like Cypress that grew in a swamp, you know, has withstood 150 years of hurricanes and humidity, you can bring it back. You can revitalize wood floors, you know, historic bricks, all these sorts of things can be made new again. And so I do encourage people who are conscientious enough to want to save what's original to reach out to us.
Somebody texted in, and were some shotguns built with the lumber of wooden river barges, not practical to get them back upriver for reuse, so they disassembled and the lumber was used to build the houses in New Orleans. Any truth to that, as far as you know, Danielle?
There is truth to that. Yeah, those are called bargeboard houses, mm-hmm. and you can find that when you remove the plaster or the drywall and look underneath, and you can see it's very identifiable when you find houses that were made with bargeboard. And those tend to be more in the downtown neighborhood, so Marigny Bywater. And those are older, you know, really a lot older homes, really 19th century homes. But that is true. And isn't that such a cool factoid?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a picture of a raised center hall cottage in the Garden District. Mm-hmm. And it looks like some wainscoting on the porch ceiling, I guess the top of the porch. And then when it comes to window trim and everything else, somebody texted in about the paint colors, what's traditional, what's not, and how did these colors become traditional, or do people just paint them whatever colors they want?
Yeah, so we actually, PRC just published a book about this last October.
Really?
It's called Painting the Town. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fabulous book. You got to check it out. We have incredible photography, and we explain all of this. So for a Garden District Center Hall cottage, traditionally it's going to be white because most of those were built in the Greek Revival style. And this came later. This came with the Americans moving from the Northeast down to New Orleans, bringing their Protestant values, valuing the color white as pure and good. And that was really more in the mid-19th century. Before that, it was the Creoles. It was the French, the Spanish, and of course the Africans, the enslaved people and the free people of color, who were here with their Catholic values, loving color. So the historic French Quarter, which was our original city, and the early downtown neighborhoods, Treme, Marigny, Bywater, those were vibrantly colorful neighborhoods from the get-go. And they have remained that since. And it is because of that Catholic influence, the African influence of the people who settled those neighborhoods. So those were our original neighborhoods. And as the Americans moved in and developed towards uptown, they developed the Garden District in uptown, you started to see more whites, more neutral colors. And today, you know, with the exception of the French Quarter, today people just paint their homes whatever is their fancy. And you can walk into, you know, Benjamin Moore and pick 10,000 colors, which you couldn't do back in the 1800s. You really were limited to what you could choose. But with the exception of the French Quarter is the only historic district where historic color is regulated.
Yeah, and matter of fact, I'm getting ready to talk about helm paint and decorating. I can see here on the list, and I know they have a list of Benjamin Moore colors that the Vieux-Carré Commission approved, but I'm not trying to make this into a commercial or anything. Tell me more about that book, Paint the Town.
Yeah, so it's basically an explanation for why New Orleans is such a historically colorful city. And we prove through old watercolor paintings that were used as real estate transaction records at the city's notarial archives. Those are proof that from even the early 1800s, we had a very colorful, vibrant city where our buildings were reds, golds, oranges. And then later, as modern paint became, you know, was developed, lots of greens and blues and those kind of other more exotic colors. It's really a vibrant book. We've got famed Times-Picayune photographer Chris Granger to shoot over 2,000 photographs for the book, and we really had a tough time narrowing it down, but it's just kind of a visual feast. I encourage everybody to check it out.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about how the neighborhoods themselves kind of resemble New Orleans, where diversity, I guess, in a lot of different neighborhoods and also different influences of Spanish and French. And what happened with bungalows when I guess the 40s or the 50s came along and the influence they had on architecture. And a lot of people are texting in. I thought it'd be fun to talk about it. Jordan Fiegel did, too. And it is, because we drive around it every day. And thank you, Danielle, for taking the time that y'all do to preserve all of this, because I don't want to be I don't want to pick a city and pick on it, but I, you know what I mean? I just don't want to be cosmopolitan.
Yes.
USA, where it's just the plain everyday stuff, house after house after house. 9:36, 24 till 10, talking about New Orleans architecture. Back in a flash, traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10. Somebody texted me a quote, a friend from Tennessee Williams. America has only three cities, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. Everywhere else is Cleveland. Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center, New Orleans. Maybe that's what I was trying to clumsily say before.
You got it. No worries.
Somebody texted in and said, ask you about square-cut nails. Now, whenever somebody texts something like that, of which I'm not aware, I always do a little research to make sure I'm not saying anything dirty on the radio, because sometimes people try to trick you into that. But tell me about the use of square. No, they do. Trust me. And they've caught me a couple of times.
Oh,
but
boy.
Tell me about square nails and their use.
Yeah. So, you know, back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when these homes were being built, just like you couldn't go to Helm Paint and just choose a color, you couldn't go to Home Depot and just buy a bag of nails. You had to actually forge the nails from the metal. And so in some of these older houses, what you'll find in the original construction are, you know, hand-hewn nails. Some of them are square, and you can see that they were actually, you know, forged with, you know, with a hammer and fire, and that that's what's holding the houses together, as well as, you know, a lot of these early houses have really beautiful woodworking and the ways that the wood beams lace into each other, that also structurally helps support the properties.
Tell me about this house on Carrollton Avenue that has an I guess an oriental look to it. I don't know how to describe it otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
With the square columns. Do you know the house I'm talking about, or a bungalow look, and it's got like a covered carport on the side? At some point, are there different types? Did different areas of the city evolve architecturally and copy trends from other areas in the nation as, say, the 40s and 50s and time progressed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why the Garden District had so much Greek Revival architecture, is because it was developed in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and that's why when Greek Revival architecture was so popular. And so absolutely, something like the house you're describing, mm-hmm. maybe more of a one-off. There's also a home on Napoleon Avenue that really has this pagoda roof and very much looks Asian. So mm-hmm. there are revival styles of different types of houses. You can have a Tudor type house that looks like it should be in Germany or England. You know, Gothic, we have some Gothic revival homes across the city, one on Carrollton Avenue that's really gorgeous. And so you have these kind of one-offs, but it is true that different neighborhoods, because they were developed later, I mean, the whole back part of the city wasn't developed until it was drained, mm-hmm. and until the technology to drain that part of the city happened. So it was swamp. And so as mid-city and the lakefront neighborhoods were, you know, built later in the city's history, their architecture reflected more of the styles that were prevalent at the time. So Gentilly, mid-city, have a lot of bungalows because they, you know, that was popular in the 1920s and 30s. And the lakefront neighborhoods have a lot of mid-century modern architecture because they were developed and, you know, really came to prominence in the middle of the 20th century. One of my favorite examples is Algiers Point, which we're actually going to be doing a home tour, our spring home tours in Algiers Point, April 5th and 6th, so in 2 weekends. We encourage you guys all to come out. It's going to be fabulous. But Algiers Point feels so cohesive as a neighborhood because there was a huge fire in the late 1800s, and it burned much of the neighborhood. But they were, the Algerians were resilient and decided to rebuild quickly. And when they did, you know, they all rebuilt their homes with kind of these Eastlake styles, many of them, fanciful, you know, woodworking on the front of their homes. And it was all reflective of that kind of same, those all built kind of at the same time. And so now you're left with a neighborhood that really feels like this moment in time of the late 1800s. And they've kept that preserved today. And it's a really special thing.
It is. For people that have not been to Algiers Point or driven around, I suggest they do it because that's where my dad grew up. That's where, you know, I'm very familiar with the area. I wish they'd bring back Sussland's Bakery, but that's something else. Somebody texted in, said they live in a 300-year-old center parlor home downriver. Porch ceilings are all sky blue. Interior rooms have always been colors of blue room, pink room, green room, yellow room. With all our problems, I couldn't see myself living anywhere else. That's what the text says. Is that the same as a center hall cottage, and what is that?
Perhaps, or it could be more of a plantation-style home, you know, like a French colonial-style home, we call it, kind of like the Pitot House or the Spanish Customs House on Bayou St. John, if you're familiar with those properties. Those were very French West Indies style, where they had large porches and lots of doors and windows to, you know, have breezes coming through the homes. And those were traditionally two-story homes where you would have, you know, the first floor could flood. So you wouldn't keep stuff down there that could get wet. And the living quarters really were on the upper floor. So that might be what they're referring to. But the presence of color on the inside of the house does suggest that, and because it was so old, that also, you know, it was probably a French home or maybe built by a Spaniard, but more likely someone French built that home. And what a beautiful thing that it is surviving today. How cool.
Somebody texted in about the French Quarter and wrought iron and actually more Spanish than French. Talk about that, Danielle, if you would, please.
Yeah, the architecture in the French Quarter really is very Spanish. And the way that the Jackson Square is laid out, having a town square with a church and the seat of government, that was very Spanish. The law of the Indies, or what the Spaniards used, those were the rules the Spaniards used to develop in the New World. And so if you go to Havana, you go to San Juan, you're going to see architecture that looks very similar to what we have in the French Quarter, and the town layout that looks very similar to the French Quarter. And so the French Quarter, you know, original, you know, a lot of the French Quarter burned again and again. And when it was rebuilt under Spanish rule. And so a lot of the building elements that you'll see in the French Quarter are actually Spanish and not French.
When it comes to repurposed materials, somebody wants to know if there's somebody that does that for you. If you want to buy a home and save what's in there, do you have to do it yourself? Because you're talking about taking it apart, Danielle, if I understand correctly, and it's a long text, but what they're asking is brick by brick, cleaning the bricks up, getting them ready to be laid again, cypress flooring, picking it up panel by panel, refinishing it and reusing those kind of things, right, if you want to be authentic, as well as updating the plumbing to modern day.
Of course, yeah, that's essential. And you can also, a lot of environmental, you know, green things like solar panels, certain types of insulation. So a lot of that stuff can be compatible with historic homes as well. So we encourage people to modernize the homes as long as it doesn't damage the historic materials. A lot of times you don't have to take things apart to fix them. You know, there might be a brick wall. You're not going to take the brick wall apart. You're going to do tuck pointing. So you're going to, you might scrape out all the mortar, replace the mortar, make sure the bricks are solid. And if they are, you're going to leave them in place. So it just depends. But the key, Tommy, is to find a contractor who really does have experience working on historic homes, because a lot of people claim to have experience and they don't. And that's when we saw that so much after Katrina, especially, that people just had their homes, you know, destroyed by people who didn't know how to use historic materials, ruined the historic materials, maybe pulled out stuff they didn't need to pull out. You know, plaster walls are incredible. If you have them, keep them forever. They don't let mold grow. They can get wet. They'll dry out. You don't need to rip it out like you do drywall. So there's stuff about these historic houses that you need to find an expert who really knows. And there are plenty of contractors and tradespeople in the city who do know, but there's plenty who don't. So make sure you vet your whoever's working on your house very carefully.
I'm not going to embarrass myself and tell you how old I was when I realized that there was a way besides sheetrock to put up walls with the, what do you call it, lathe and plaster and all that, and I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
But real quick, when it comes to houses with so-called basements, I remember somebody had a house in old Algiers that had one of these. How prevalent was that where they would build the house raised and they would call it a basement, but it was actually, like you're saying, either parking or extra area in case the house flooded? And let me piggyback real quick. I took a picture of a TV shot a while back where every house in the neighborhood was flooded except for the one that was raised, and that's why they built houses that were raised back in the day. Talk about the prevalence of these so-called basements, et cetera, and how common are they, and do people keep them when they buy a house with those?
Yeah, so raised basement homes, there's plenty of them around the city, and you will see them, again, more in the homes that were built in the 20th century, maybe early 20th century, so you're going to see them in Broadmoor, you're going to see them in Mid-City. Of course, you'll see them all over the city, but they're really more prevalent in neighborhoods like that that were developed in the early 20th century. And the thing is that raised basement homes were, just like you said, they were developed so that, like those French West Indies style houses, the first floor could flood, but that's okay because, you know, you only used it for storage or you parked down there or, you know, whatever. And you lived on the upper floors. The problem comes in modern day when we want to, you know, monetize every square inch of our house. And so to return these raised basements, which typically only have like 7 or 8 foot ceiling heights, we've turned them into apartments or, you know, living spaces, workspaces. And guess what? They're going to flood, and that's going to cause real problems. So insurance companies are really raising the red flag and telling some people, listen, if you want us to insure your house, you cannot use that raised basement as living space or as an apartment because that is not insurable.
30 seconds left, Danielle. Tell me something people can look for as they drive around the city.
Look for the colors and just admire the creativity of our citizens and our friends here in New Orleans. I mean, we have these incredible buildings that were built by our ancestors hundreds of years ago. We're keeping them strong, but we're also displaying our, you know, individuality with colors and plants, and the way we decorate our homes is really, it really makes me love this city so much to see how people care for and decorate their homes.
And it's a shame to drive around and not appreciate it. Quickly, website for the Preservation Resource Center.
PMCNO.org.
Thank you. Have a great day, Danielle. Appreciate it. We'll be back in a flash. WWL.